happens when you just amuse furniture ends up in the music.
Hey, welcome. Actually, I should put one of these cameras I have on the audience so everybody can see everybody in the room instead of me being the ones on the voice all the time. So welcome to November. November 1st today?
Yeah.
Yes. I ate enough Halloween candy yesterday and everything. Okay. I thought we'll go to the, I got to start. Okay, I'm recording. And now I need to share my screen. Share the screen. Okay, and then I need to hide the controls. Yell if you can't see that. Oh, and then I forgot to open up the chat in case anybody online wants to chat with me. I can see your questions. Are there any questions to begin with? Anything about the data workshop last week? Any of the other instruments? Anything that you found interest in that maybe other probes?
This was an
IMPACTS data workshop. So for Andy and maybe the people that don't know, we had an online data workshop for users of the IMPACTS data on Wednesday. They went over the project and they went over the ER2 aircraft. Did I tell maybe Christian and other people for the radar, one thing I thought was interested, it seems that on the DAC or on the field catalog, they mentioned the composite radar data from the National Weather Service. Did you catch that, Christian? Mm-hmm. So there was supposed to be this, I think Joe from UW mentioned it, because we had done a paper where they have a NISO or someone, Oklahoma, they have this gridded data for the National Weather Service. And I forget what it's called.
It's the MRMS, multi-radar, multi-sensor, I think.
Multi-radar, multi-sensor, yes.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes. And did you catch Andy, Andrew? They had that archived. Where for the IMPACTS project? Is it at the DAC?
I don't know. It might be both, actually. I know I've referenced it, so I'm gonna assume it's on the field catalog.
And I think Joseph mentioned that they did it a little bit differently in 2022 than 2000, but it's basically a composite gridded National Weather Service based radar data set over the Northeast, right?
Well, yeah, I may be getting different things confused, but MRMS is over the US.
Yeah.
Then I know Stacy also runs a processing where she computes it in a gridded form to where you can look at it like at a given height level, mm-hmm. look at composite radar reflectivity. And I wonder if that was, I guess I wasn't paying close enough attention when he presented that, but I wonder if that was maybe what he was referencing.
So, yeah, Can't remember exactly what, but
I guess it depends if it's 2D or 3D. So the MRMS would be like the 2D composite, just highest reflectivity in the level. But then Stacy takes that a step further and creates a 3D thing where you can go in and say, you know, I want radar reflectivity at 3 kilometers or something like that, if you're comparing to in situ data or something along those lines.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I think a lot of us in situ measurement people have an interest in the radar data. So I was thinking that we should look at that. What's available, we can always ask for clarification on that. Yeah, we got all these radars on ER2, but yet we all get the National Weather Service. I mean, they give you the big picture, so that can be very useful. So that's what I learned on Wednesday, is that that data is available. And Thursday, of course, our in-situ probes and the Whisper. Anything else? Of course, they got the calibrated winds with the vertical velocities from TAMS, right? AVAPS is a drop zone. I gotta get all these acronyms right. But they got the good wind calibration, and that should be good. So any other comments, questions? Everybody totally understands all the instruments that everybody was talking about. Okay. I'm sharing my screen. Right, you can see it. Everybody can see it online.
Hey, David, real quick before we get started, I wonder if you may comment on what the status is of the instruments at Wallops. Like, is all that going well?
Yeah, we just had a telecom. This is being recorded. Jennifer Moore is online. I think in the last couple of hours, Jen said that we power checked the HVPS-3 on HVPS-3B. We had to send
the vertical one.
The vertical one?
Yep.
I guess I could pull up all the instruments, but I reported that the RICE probe should be getting there today, the second RICE. That can go on a hot wire boom. We may lose that at some point in the field project, depending when they need to start another citation field project. The standby crowd dropper probe has been calibrated and checked at DMT, so that looks like that's going to be available. We got approval for a second standby 2DS probe from ARM that they usually fly on the PMNL aircraft. So we're working out the logistics of that. Before any of our probe powers came on, we had a probe issue in the sense that one of the pins on that are inside the canister, I didn't make a plot of it, but the pins where the probes go into the canisters, they get pushed in and they lock in the back when you screw them in. And then there's 24 pins in the back of the PMS cans, we call them, standard 24 pins that we use, one side kind of for power, one set for data. And a couple of them pins were bent. So the probe canister has been sent back to spec for replacement of the pins and a leak check again, because they have to take the plug apart and the back of the canister apart. Jen said that the HVPS-3B was power checked. They're working on a 2DS to see if we can test that, just like we did with the cord in the lab to check the lasers. And then we have to proceed through and check the power and data on all the instruments. So we'll see how this goes. And they have, you know, we'll see if we can get some check fright, and we're going to do a check fright for all the instruments after. So the list of orders of the frights are a conformance fright, I guess they call it, where it's an instrument, aircraft crew only. And we're going to try to run our data systems. We'll start them up beforehand, exit the airplane. They'll go fly, do all their stuff. And then we'll come back, turn off our data systems after we get in the airplane, after they land, so that we record all the data during the conformance check, and we can process that. That's on the 22nd. So that is 3 weeks from today. So we got 3 weeks to get all the power on all the instruments. And then the following week, we can start with a instrument check flight. And that's a short order flight for an hour or two to check just that we get everything working in the air. And then we'll probably proceed with a winds calibration flight of 6 hours-ish. And then probably a crowd check calibration flight. So me and Lee will be there. Christian Nader is going to come out with me to begin with. And then Michael Wilt will be back. And Andrew, here you're coming out too. So we look forward to seeing you at the airplane. And maybe we'll have to do this reverse. So I'll be there finishing up the last couple of weeks of this class, and I'll have to take my little mic or something. We can look at the instruments on the airplane. So I don't think they let me do a class from the airplane when it's flying. No, not yet. So that's my summary. So things are progressing, but we already have problems to overcome.
More on schedule than last year, though.
Huh?
Definitely more on schedule than last
year. Christian is saying yes. But that's because you're here and not out there.
are there any updates? Jen, do you have any updates on the other probes? Like is the Hawkeye on the plane?
Yeah, so the Hawkeye is on the plane, but it's not hooked up. The 2DS, I just need to put it into the can, which I'm planning on doing today. They have the boom mounted on the plane. Now it's off the plane because they realized there was a thread issue with their the screws that mount it onto the pylon. So that's off. And the rice is on the plane. It's all hooked up. I just need to hook it up to the M300, which I did right before class. So,
and the rice, you should be able to get data from it. I looked at it ahead of time. And as long as you can power the probe, it should send out data. I checked that it does send data right away. And we will also want to check that we're getting data and from the instruments on the hot wire once we get them all set.
Yeah, and I have a question at some point on for the second race. We need to update the tables, and I guess I'll need help kind of going through that a little bit.
Yeah, I don't worry about it. I'll write you some tables and send you. For now, if you want to check it, just plug it into the same serial port as the other one, or I'll send you something here momentarily. I'll get it done. At least we can acquire the data and stuff. It won't be long for me. If you could, the other thing you could do, Jen, if you have the M300 there, is top a set of the tables and send me, or put on the NAS drive. Do we have the latest set of tables?
I think we have one from last year, but I can update them.
Yeah, so you should try to create a TAW file of the directory with the tables in them. tar.space/cvf. F is a file name of the TAW file you create, and then the directory name, space directory name. And that should create a TAW file that you can copy off with the USB. So if you could put them on there, I can start with the tables and then I can update them, and then you can upload the new tables. Because I can work on all the M300 stuff here, because you're probably so busy there, but at least get a set of the tables. I don't think we have ever archived them. You can extract them from the SEA data files also, but it's better to get the actual ones off the airplane. Good. We're avoiding our lecture today so that we won't get through it. Other questions? Okay, you see my screen? Okay, the first thing I'd like you guys to do, and I owe you a couple of quizzes. I'm going to try to write some quizzes again, get back to having people look at the quizzes like we used to at the beginning of class. So one on a WCM and then one on uncertainties. So, let me hope. What? And I don't know if I can do this. I thought I fixed that right before class. Okay. What about this one? I got this one. Maybe I can download this and I'll have to update them, but you should read over this PDF file once I fix that. You can actually install a link. And I'll just try to go off of my PDF because I was rushing right before class and I saw the errors without the permissions, but I thought I fixed it, but I must not have totally fixed the problem. So anyway, you can go and grab the PDF and I'll see if I can figure out how to do, now what's my computer doing? It's complaining about something. Okay. Stuff goes behind the other one. Okay. And I forget what this. Is this open it up? Open with. And it's so hard sometimes to see what. Okay, that must be. Sign, convert, create. How do I get rid of the full screen? Get rid of that. Get rid of that. Find text. Get rid of my screen controls again. And I'm not familiar with the software. I keep changing our software. Well, maybe I can just do it like that. I'll just go like this so you can see what the values are. I won't figure out how to do the full screen. Somehow. Anyway, you can see it, download the PDF, but I want to talk about errors and uncertainties and some of this stuff at the beginning will probably hopefully be pretty simplistic, but we'll get into how we calculate and propagate errors and come up with an uncertainty. And I love my quotes here. A value without uncertainty contains no information. We always do this in science. People say, here's what the answer is. How uncertain is that? We don't know. So a seminar speaker last week went into uncertainties for models. It was great. They were talking about their energy models and uncertainty because the customer wants to know how well and what's the uncertainty of the wind and solar energy prediction. So uncertainties are very necessary for real information, but preliminary data a lot of times doesn't have it. And which one? There's a lot of these sayings in terms of, you know, mathematics can really not refer to reality if and that as far as the laws of mathematics refer to error, they are certain. And as far as they are certain, they don't refer to reality. And you know, when you get more and more complex, like in the atmosphere, precise statements lose meaning and meaningful statements lose precision. So it's sometimes hard to have the right questions that you can actually answer in complex situations. And of course, I like my Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Demand and doubt and uncertainty. So we want it, right? Sources of error. So nice with a quiz question of four sources of errors: static, dynamic, drift, and exposure. We talk a lot about this in the past. I've done rain gauge calibration labs where there's static and dynamic errors. Static errors represent are errors that are present when the input is constant. So you have one constant temperature, one constant rain rate, and the error there is the static error. Dynamic is errors that are present when input changes. When you have, you have change in inputs. Maybe the airspeed of the aircraft, if you change that, you keep it steady. Static errors, they talked about the winds, level flights, you have static errors, but you get dynamic errors when you start changing the pitch and roll of the airplane. The inputs change too rapidly, and then your errors go up. So you compound your errors. Drift errors result in sensor changes with time. Oh, that was, I think, one of the things is that I think Darren or someone mentioned that the Rosemount temperature might be off by half a degree. So I've seen this in all probes when we have two Rosemount temperature probes, which they have one on the aircraft. We get them both calibrated, put them on the plane. They agree within a tenth of the degree. And then over the years, they spread apart. And it seemed that one of the instruments would drift, that the it was always a wider and wider separation between the two temperature probes. So that's a drift error. So when it calibrated initially, it could be good to the 0.1 degrees Celsius uncertainty, but then you add a drift error over the years. So I'm wondering if they have and checked and recalibrated the temperature. And that's important when you have something like humidity, where you want to look at the temperature and you get values above 100% and that. And of course, my favorite error, I think, is the exposure error. Error is due to imperfect coupling between the sensor and what is measured, which is difficult on a big moving aircraft, because you want to make a measurement of temperature as if the aircraft wasn't there. Right, so exposure, we have the tubes, we have the tips. These are exposure areas when we shatter the particles and they go into our sampling volume. We're not coupling the instrument to the environment. So definitions, hopefully everybody's can follow, understand. Questions? I got Christian shaking his head. Yes. Any questions? Pretty simple. But try to think of what they are and what examples are of different errors. So them are types of errors. Definition of errors. Hopefully you heard and know the difference. For the term error represents imprecision and inaccuracy of a measurement or numerical calculation. There's absolute and relative errors. So what is the error? A 10% error is a relative error. Absolute error is the difference between what your approximation is and what the true value is. And this is our problem with when we go back with what the liquid water measurement is for when we looked at the King probe, the WCM, what is the true value? It's hard to come up with that value. And we need to make sure that we would compare something that is true and you don't have artifacts that would affect the measurement. But a lot of these are difficult because we don't know what the true value is. So that's what we do when we go out of cloud. We know what the true value is out of cloud. It's zero. I still remember, was it you, Andy, or someone came to my lab when I had three CCN counters, or Tony Granger or someone that came in and said, oh, I had four or something. They said, you'll never get them four instruments to agree. No way. And I said, yes, I can get them to agree. They all measure zero at the same time. So getting a zero value is not necessarily trivial. Getting zero liquid water content, getting your winds to be the consistent one direction to the other, which we do on the winds calfrights. So some trivial answers are good. We should make sure we're measuring our crowd probes, zero crowds when we're on the ground, when we're in clear air. Absolute error, relative error is just normalized by the true value. So a lot of times we'll put that in terms of a percentage or 0.01 and then convert it to 10%. So pretty easy, hopefully freshmen.
It's hard to use the
temperature. To get a zero, yeah. Temperature is hard to get a zero temperature correct. At least
express the temperature in a percent.
Typically that's why in terms of percent. Yeah, so how would you do that in terms of
you're off by half a degree, what percentage is that? Half of the absolute temperature?
Yeah, well, that's why you can kind of use the absolute temperature scale, but it's a very different if you use Celsius or Fahrenheit scales, right?
Yeah.
So
be careful to specify what you consider to be the true value. And
yeah.
What you consider to be, the zero error.
Yeah, what's the zero error? Temperature, sometimes we can get melting point of or thermodynamic equilibrium point of water, ice baths and stuff that we can have some thing, but temperature is very hard to get an accurate measurement of and to get.
You have to be careful about how you express it too.
Yeah.
Like I say, you can't do a percentage on a temperature.
Yeah. I guess we never really did that. I always kind of think of the best is a Rosemount, which if you're, like I said, I think we had both of our Rosemount temperature probes within 0.1 degrees, and that's the best I've ever seen. Sometimes several tenths of a degree, any temperature measurements is hard. And that, of course, makes humidity measurements and other thermodynamic properties hard, I guess. So,
do they do any calibration of the temperature sensors on the P3?
I think they do only what we've done in terms of the manufacturer one. And that would be the other thing is, do they... that's what Darren brought up last week, because he was looking at the humidity, and he gets a pretty good vapor concentration. And so he can't be above, you can't have 102% relative humidity with respect to water and clouds. And so he suspects that the temperature is an issue because of that. Come back and say, well, if our liquid water's off, so what's the error of half a degree in temperature? guess it's hard to put into, like you said, a relative value. Anyway, let's just go on bravely. Random systematic errors. So you hear these terms a lot, and the uncertainties are due to both random and systematic errors. Random errors are systematic statistical fluctuations in measurement data due to limitations of the measurement device. So random errors usually result in the experiment inability to take the same measurements in exactly the same way. So you try to measure it, just try to measure the length of something. People will take a ruler or something, read the values off, another person will read it. You'll get slightly different values because you can't really see exactly what it is, how you're looking at it. So random errors, same measurement, just repeating the same one. Systematic errors are reproducible inaccuracies that are consistent in the same direction. So consistently off by the same value. And they're often due with a problem that persists throughout the experiment. So sometimes it's, if you have these systematic errors, the calibration isn't quite right. So that's why we don't want to reapply calibrations every single flight, because they're all going to be systematically a little bit different. And then you introduce more random errors. So sometimes better to always be consistent than inducing a lot of random errors by reapplying different calibrations. And they're very hard to track down sometimes. You find a systematic error. Tell you the story when I was a PhD student. I was calibrating our crowd condensation nuclei counter. And I did it two different ways, one with a video system to count the droplets over a volume, and another one to introduce particles of a known composition and size that they all should be activating as. And I'm happy I get agreement within 10%. Comes to find out, I made two systematic errors in both methods. And then I come and find that systematically they're about 50% off. And then I get two different calibrations. And now I go to my advisor and say, now I really understand it. I found my systematic errors and now everything is right. And you can have systematic errors that give you agreement between your instruments. But that doesn't mean that the measurement is actually the true value. So that's why I resist trying to make one instrument match another. We don't know what the truth is. I can make all my liquid water measurements agree, but which one is the right one? And is that really the thing to do? Because they shouldn't all agree, and there's other things that haven't been kept into account. Mistakes are not part of errors or uncertainty. If you do a calculation wrong, that is not a random or systematic error. That's a mistake. Just writing down the reading wrong is the mistake. And they're not part of the error analysis. So mistakes are not there. We assume that we don't do anything wrong. We assume all our processing code, everything is mistake-free, and there's no way to account for that in our error analysis. So any questions? Basic, simple stuff, right? Okay, I think I have some. Oh, one more definition, accuracy and precision. Please, you should know this. Accuracy is how it refers to the true value. So I got my graph here and we have the truth. The input is not changing, but the value I measure is changing. So accuracy is how close you are to that true value. Precision is how close the values agree with each other. Sometimes it's better to be precise than accurate. Okay, I love to have calibrations and accurate measurements, but a lot of scientific analysis could be done with precise, with precision measurements. So where would be an example where precision would be more important than accurate measurements? Think of concentration measurements of crowds or aerosols. Anybody want to tell me when is a precise measurement more important? Or maybe I'll put it the other way. When do you not need an accurate measurement? Say I made a new instrument. I'm measuring the concentration of aerosols that activate for crowd particles. And I have no idea what's in the atmosphere. And I'm just taking this all over to trace. I'm going to go up to Alaska, measure there, measure California, measure over the ocean. So if you're looking for changes in different areas, you know, you want to see, is it cleaner in the ocean than it is over land? Are there more crowd droplets over the ocean than the land? You don't necessarily need to have accurate measurements. You just need to be precise so that you can compare one area to the other. And that's great, right?
So wouldn't you want like all of the cloud probes to be precise than to be accurate, because it can't be accurate because you don't know the true values?
Well, I think some of the modelers would want accurate measurements because they're going to put in models and they want to know, you know, how them values then compare and propagate through to other processes.
Yeah, but how do you know it's accurate?
It's hard, right? So it's easy to get precise measurements in some ways than accurate ones. So for example, an aerosol instrument, we can calibrate the flow rate of the instrument so we can get the sample volume easier. Can we measure the sample volume? I didn't talk about it too much, but we went through and defined what the sample volume of the crowd droplet probes are by putting what are droplets in there to accurately measure the sample volume. So if we get that accurate enough, and then we know that we can count individual particles, then we got a more accurate measurement, but we're fundamentally not measuring that quantity in terms of an accurate measurement. So when you go back and you calibrate something, where's your calibration standard?
A single droplet counter should be easy to.
Yep.
Absolute accuracy is because you artificially generate known concentration.
Yeah, but you have to know what the volume over what you're generating or the flow rate. So there you can get the flow rates and you know each, you measure individual particles. So that concentration is a lot easier than sizing in some ways. because, you know, you have to have some standard to compare with our calibration beads.
You can back out your volume by your flow rate.
Yeah, for our aerosol instruments. So, but we need to know the airspeed of the crowd probes, for example.
Right.
You know, and so you can consider that as part of your error. How much do we know the airspeed? How much do we know the sample volume or sample area? And then you combine that. So some things are easier than others in terms of both concentration and the size. So that you don't have any more measurements, we try to just do one calibration. And also, ideally, use one probe, but what happens when your probes don't work and we got another probe? Then you have to switch your analysis, and, you know, the two probes don't necessarily agree, and then which one's right? And the same thing with our fast CDP and our crowd dropper probe. Which one is right? Why don't they always agree? Is it really a shattering issue? We can do some more work on that. Because we don't know what a concentration of a crowd is, for example. Let's make a standard crowd and fly our airplane through it. Random errors. Here's examples of some random errors. This is voltage measurement on two different times, on two different types of airplanes. Well, this is our old citation, our new citation. 25 hertz voltage measurements of slide slip angle. This is the angle that you go into the winds calculation. It's from a pressure transducer. You can do the same thing with static dynamic pressure. It's a pressure transducer measurement. The data system and analog digital boards were the same on both of these flights. Given the same Y scale, -2 to +2. And it's the same 40 minutes of data on the x-axis. So you can see on the plot on the left, you have any values really go above plus or minus half a volt, where you have other ones that are up to almost a volt or a volt and a half. You also see there's areas here where there's very little change. But here, there's a little bit before takeoff, but you see all this data. So this is random noise on our A to D boards.
Could it be just different flying conditions?
It could be, but this is on every single flight, on multiple transducers. And I had a hard time. I think they finally got rid of this, but... and then you could look at the data too and look at the periodicity of the randomness of the data. There's some noise, and it's not just one hertz noise. It's actually data, and it's not, I guess the other thing is, if you ask about the different maneuvers, these are both level flights. So while the magnitude could be changed, the variability shouldn't be a lot more in terms of how much variability there was. We could look at stuff just looking at the analog to digital boards with nothing connected up to it. It's basically a grounding issue.
Did you say that they fixed it?
Supposedly they did now.
You know what the issue, the main issue was?
Something to do with grounding the power inverters. And it's very hard to track down because you have multiple inverters on the aircraft. And of course you hook it up and it seems to be good, but they basically redid the whole entire power distribution system. But it's a correctable error because do we really care about stuff at 25 Hertz? We just go through and average. So you average the data enough, and you can get rid of the random data, random errors. Average, and you should eliminate it. Just like, you know, if you, this value here is truly random, if I average over enough time period, I get close to that true value. So I can average the data and you can get rid of that points. And that's what we end up doing. Because this is random noise that's analog on the signals. What got even harder was when we had digital noise that would flip the bits. And therefore it wasn't random. It was this, you know, we'll be measuring around zero temperatures. And then all of a sudden we get to 50 because one of the bits got switched into digital data. So typically you don't get that much noise, but you can get so much noise that your digital data is affected too. So average the data, you get back to a slide slip angle that reduces that amount of noise. And then you can see these up and down changes here. So these are really changes, like this one's high and this one's low. Okay, which is really hard to pick out of all this random noise. So the phenomenon you want is not at 25 Hertz. So you can just average it and get rid of that. And you wouldn't even notice the noise if you looked at the 10 second data. You can look at a histogram, see how they're distributed. This is what it is for the slide slip angle. You can see that, you know, it flies with a little, not a zero slice slip, would mean it's, slice slip is with the nose of the airplane a little bit, not directly into the wind. So one of the pylons is a little bit off or something, and you have to, you're not flying exactly straight with the airflow. So, and of course, these are small values, and this is a small amount of measurement. The other thing to consider is systematic characterization. What single number represents a group of measurements? So there are not just one value to choose. Mode, medium, mean. Typically, sum of all data divided by the total number of measurements is a mean. The average is typically what's used, but is that always the best? Medium values may be better, or sometimes the mode. So when you think a medium value might be better than a mean? Of course, if it's normally distributed, they're the same, but if it's not normal, your mediums could be different. I think about my case of if you're comparing a Intuitu measurement with some satellite data or something, the medium may be better because of how often they want to compare, you know, how often the measurement comes up would maybe be better than the average of how much it comes up, because the mode, no, that would be how the medium is, I guess the 50th percentile of measurement is where the measurement occurs 50% of the time. The mode is, how often a certain value comes up. Usually that's not because we're taking so many values that I can't think of where the mode would be, except if you had something like a 1 and a 0 or something, a yes or no, how often it occurred. But the mediums where you have a distributions.
You could have multiple modes in one distribution.
Yep, you can have multiple modes too.
Different peaks.
Yeah, how often certain values peak. So that's the average. Then there's also the characteristic of the spans, spread, symmetry of the distribution. So if you work at something like this, you know, it's pretty Gaussian. But you can characterize also, there's multiple ways to characterize the span of how the width or how much it goes between the values, how much it spread of the data, the symmetry of the data, and in my CPROP program, we calculate these all, you know, min, max. So there's a span type of values, and then there's different types of means, trimean, so you can look at the different statistical distributions. So, and I like the quartiles or the percentiles of the distribution, particularly when it's not log normal. So indication of uncertainty. You should take a statistics course to get the values of the statistics. But any questions? I don't know. I like, a lot of times we just use an average and a standard deviation or several standard deviations. And these are the statistics for one of the frights, of how many points you can have and the summation and so on and so forth. Uncertainty. So instruments are calibrated, data sets are not. I don't believe in that terminology that data can be calibrated. It's the instrument is calibrated. Data sets, you can see how well they match, you can move them, you can compare. But I don't like the terminology of calibrating the data sets. They really mean to make one match the other. It's not really a standard or a value. So you compare the instrument with a known standard, you know, something that we know what the weight of this is. It's so many kilograms. We know what the volume is. So we know a standard that we can all pass around and compare. I like the term instrument performance checks to see how well the instrument's working. It's kind of like a calibration, but we're just checking to see if it's working. And please think of significant figures. This goes way back. All but the last number is certain. The last number is uncertain. So in totally really applying significant figures, what's the range of 20.8? So that 0.8 is the uncertain value. So It's 20. It's between 20 and 21. And, you know, be careful not to give a value of 20.8256. Okay, if someone can measure temperature to the thousandth decimal place, I want to see that instrument. You know, so that uncertainty represents something.
So what's the range of 20.8?
Yeah, it should be between 20 and 21. No.
We know it's 8, we know it's 9, it's 9.
No, the 8 is the uncertain value. The 0 is the certain, the 20, the 0 is certain. The 8 is the uncertain value. So I guess
it's
tech.
It's uncertain, but we know that it's not bigger than 0.9 or not as small as 0.7.
No. I argue that you don't know that it's but it's the uncertainty that the value is uncertain if you look at the definition of significant figures.
I've never thought of it.
Yeah, that's the way most people think it's that, but that's not really the true definition of the significant figure. Because if it's really between point 7 and 0.8 and 0.9, it's that then you would give 20.85, and that would be between 0.8 and 0.9, but it's really the last value that is uncertain. It's not between 0.7 and 0.9. Because you estimate it when you look at like a temperature or a length, think of a length scale, and you're going to measure something to the nearest meter or something. You know, it's 1 meter point, and you got to give that uncertainty of that last value that you're reading off the instrument. So is it 20.8 meters? Well, you look at it and you say, well, I know it's between 20 and 21, right? And then you say, well, okay, now what is it? Is it point, well, it's closer to 21 than it is to 20. So I'll read it as, you know, do I put in there, well, it's about, you know, it's a little bit more than 3/4 of the way. So you say 20.8 meters. So think of reading a meter stick or a measurement. Think of reading a thermometer where you have a scale. So I guess that would be the thing on here. You got tick marks every degree. And you got to estimate that value. You know it's not below 20. You know it's not above 21. But where is the tick mark when you read the uncertainty? Goes back to reading it, not necessarily like calculating. And
in that context, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And supposing you were looking at a digital thermometer that can only display the tenth of a degree, you would assume that if it's got 20.8, that it's colder than 20.9 and it's warmer than 20.7.
But what's the real uncertainty of the?
Plus or minus a tenth of an inch or a tenth of a degree.
Then why not display in 2 digits? Why not? If it's really, Should really be that last one is the uncertain value. The other way to get around that is to actually explicitly state what the uncertainty value is with a plus or minus. So that will end all the confusion. If you want to say it's 20.8 plus or minus 0.1, state that uncertainty. And then you remove that ambiguity. But without that information, I would argue that it's still the last digit that's uncertain because I have no other information. So state your uncertainties. So
the range is not really the uncertainty.
The digit is a significant figures definition, not an uncertainty definition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's given the uncertainty of the measurement, not necessarily of a calculation. So without that uncertainty, if you want to have it 0.1 or whatever uncertainty you want to give, you can give 0.02, 0.03, or 0.3, or something. But you have to state that, which is different than significant figures. So it's nice to state the significant figures so you don't have, the uncertainty, so you don't have to have that ambiguity. Okay, so the next thing is, let's see, we're going to get into a couple more things and we'll finish. A single measure rarely gives you any information. It really is the uncertainty in the measurement that we are interested in. How well do we know this? So liquid water, do we know that to a tenth of a gram per meter cubed, 0.05 grams? We really need to know that uncertainty to have a context to put in that into. So when we calculate uncertainties, there's multiple ways of doing it. We could assume all the uncertainties drive it further and further away from the true value, but it's unlikely that every one of your uncertainties would move it in one direction. So we tend to think that they're random, that one uncertainty doesn't depend on another. So that's why I say it's more probable for uncertainties in the basic measurement to combine in less extreme ways. So the quantity errors would be a probable uncertainty. So imagine you have a measurement of total temperature and true air speed, which would give you the error temperature. Total temperature is what you measure with dynamic heat in. You would think them two errors would not combine in the most extreme way, so that you would sum them up to give you the total uncertainty. It would be a random that they would be probabilistic errors. That they wouldn't just move it all in the same direction. And then we make an agreement. When do two measurements agree? When do two measurements agree within a uncertainty? So I like to use so many standard deviations. Two measurements agree within one standard deviation of uncertainty. That's a statement that you can reproduce and think about. So measurement one and two, they agree within one standard deviation, while measurements two and three, they disagree within one standard deviation. As opposed to just saying, the two measurements agree or disagree. Agreement in terms of what? And you can do this to get agreement or disagreement by adding more standard deviations so that your range would be higher. Let's go to 2, 3, 5 standard deviations. Physicists love to have 5 standard deviations of disagreement to have a new phenomenon. So again, there's nothing magical, special about one standard deviation. So if you want the measurements to agree, you might say, oh, they agree within 3 standard deviations. You know, that they're not in disagreement within 3 standard deviations. And I don't know that there is a uniform way to state that. And we'll start next time with uncertainties in variables and look at the calculations. So for preparation to understand these equations, look at the read-in once I get it online. So I will go fix that. And then we'll go over chapters 3 in the textbook. Okay, hard stuff next time. Any other questions? Everybody's leaving. I will stop sharing.
I have a quick question.
And we'll talk about uncertainties on Thursday.
Can you hear me, David?
So read that over and we'll have the harder discussion then. And
I can't be here Thursday because WMA fall meeting. Oh, it's Thursday at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Well, I would say I would miss that, but
I know
you know how much I miss it. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Can I hear you?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I hear you.
Oh. Okay. Okay, Jen can hear me. I think
I can't hear. Do I need to turn something up on my computer? Jen, you hear?
Yeah, I can hear him.
Yeah. Hello? Okay.
Jen, I hear you, right?
You can hear me.
Maybe not.
Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'll ask question next class. It's fine. I'll just put it into the chat.
Questions. Okay, you ask next class period. Okay, sounds good. Hopefully we get better connections and stuff. And Jen says she got the rice. Wonderful. Yeah, okay. You like my yellow box? Big humongous box for a dinky with a probe. There's no cables or anything in there, so I'm hoping they said they had everything. All I sent was the probe. So that would be the other thing. They said they had everything and you had all the stuff. So it should be the same as the other one. Exactly the same model. Although the software is a little different. Okay, I'll end this and we can talk next time.